Welcome to the fourth season of Version 20 Podcast, where I, Bobby Stevens, am your host with a new episode every Wednesday. If you are a serious fan of true crime and love listening to podcasts, but don't want all that small talk, you've come to the right place. We get right to the facts. Murder 20 episodes are concise and complete in 20 minutes. Less talk and more true crime. Be sure to like, share, and follow us to learn about upcoming episodes every Wednesday. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's get to this week's episode. When Mark Rogowski was 3, his parents separated, and his mother moved them from New York to San Diego County in California. The young boy, with a thin build and a mop of dark wavy hair, was a natural athlete and played baseball. But when a skateboard park opened up near his home, 7-year-old Mark gravitated to skateboarding and the freedom it provided. At 11 years old, Mark used his paper route money to buy his first skateboard. In the early 1980s, the sport grew quickly. Initially, kids snuck into empty swimming pools and used them to skate. But then as his popularity expanded, skate parks began popping up everywhere. Mark was a phenomenon, known by his nickname, Gator. His body was sleek and muscled like a gymnast, and he excelled at vertical skating, scaling the sides of the bowl with ease. By age 12, he was picked up by a local skate team, and by age 14, began his professional career. It was 1980. Growing up, Mark never knew his father and resented him. He poured that anger and depression into competing. Although Mark made it look easy, flying up 10 feet past the horizontal edge of the half pipe, spinning and landing on a skateboard with enough momentum to propel him up the other side and into a double air twist. Over the years, he had numerous wipeouts, falls, and crashes. He lost more than a few teeth and had many concussions. Mark couldn't afford the expensive skateboards he saw in the stores and knew he needed to get sponsored. At a young age, he was quick to realize that skateboarding presented him with the opportunity for freedom and independence. Mark had his own flair for skating and dressing. At the local thrift stores, he sought out shirts and shorts that stood out. Along with his clothes, his physical prowess and edginess when he skated created a unique personal style. And Vision Sports took notice. He was signed to endorse a line of clothing and was the first skateboarder to have his own pro deck. Vision Sports used Mark's good looks, affable personality, and flashy style to promote his image as a rebel. Mark even had input into the designs and graphics. As kids flew through the air, the word Gator was emblazoned on the underside. As a professional athlete, Mark began to travel and eventually worldwide. 2 years after he went pro, he won his first major event. Mark was attracting advertisers and marketing companies and making $100,000 a year. That was a lot of money for a teenager in the early 80s. His picture was splashed across the covers of magazines like Thrasher. Within a few years, his contract with Vision Sports paid him $2 for every deck sold, and he was earning $200,000 a year. Mark, like a lot of skateboarders at the time, had reached a rock star-like status, joined by Tony Hawk and Steve Caballero. But there was something special about Mark. He was charismatic and flamboyant and not shy in front of the cameras. In 1986, Mark was part of a professional contest at Mount Trashmore Park in Virginia Beach. Scheduled to perform, he arrived at the gate without a pass. He identified himself as a performer and expected to be let in. But when security refused, he strode past them. Police caught up to him and tried to stop him. Mark hauled off and punched the officer. He was promptly arrested and put in the back of a police car. Athletes on the circuit with Mark began to see two sides of his personality. He was charismatic, thoughtful, and caring, but then he could be full of anger, rage, and hatred. A documentary about Mark's skating life, called Stoked, The Rise and Fall of Gator, detailed how skateboarding was attracting anywhere from 5,000 to 8,000 fans at events. And Mark was always the star of the show. He was ranked one of the top five skateboarders in the world. Mark was at the peak of his career. His fame was growing, and so was his ego. Mark was featured on MTV and photographed with celebrities like Cindy Crawford. Fame had come quick for Mark, and some that had known him for years now found him arrogant. The sport also attracted female groupies nicknamed Skate Bettys. In 1987, at a skate show in Arizona, Mark met 15-year-old Brandy McLean and her best friend, Jessica Bergston. The two girls met in Tucson and instantly hit it off. Brandy found Jessica fun, adventurous, a free spirit who was vibrant and liked to party. Mark and Brandy began a long-distance relationship. It was a whirlwind courtship for the young lovebirds. He mailed her cards and phoned her and flew to her home on weekends to be with her. The couple appeared in Vision Streetwear ads together and also appeared in Tom Petty's music video, Free Fallen. Mark and a lot of the other skateboarders on the circuit were making a lot of money, and they began buying houses in Fallbrook, an unlikely place for young men in their prime. This vast acreage was in a rural area with rolling hills and avocado trees. When Brandy was 17, Mark asked her to move in with him. Mark could be controlling, telling her which friends she could hang out with, and he didn't like Jessica. He felt she was a bad influence. Their relationship was volatile, and she lived with him on and off. Mark would break up with Brandy, only to call her 2 weeks later and beg her to come back. As the 80s came to a close, the sport of skateboarding started to change. Gone were the vertical ramps and the half pipes. Street skating had taken over. And anything could be used to perform. Stairwells, cement walls, benches and curbs. Nothing was off limits. Mark was still vertical skating and noticed the young and up-and-coming athletes were in the street. He tried to make the transition, but just couldn't get the hang of it. The smooth ramps were replaced by bumpy stairwells and steep hills. It took a whole new skill set that Mark just didn't seem to grasp. Around the same time, Vision Sports changed Mark's image. The clothes were too high-end for the street skaters, and Mark's clothing line was no longer cool. Frustrated on many levels, he started to drink more. His moods got dark. He wasn't the fun-loving, easy-going guy anymore. Anger and rage quickly bubbled to the surface. And his teammates and fans noticed and began to distance themselves from him. In the summer of 1990, Mark was touring in Germany with his teammates when he got really drunk. One of the teammates looked out the hotel window just in time to see Mark take a swan dive. He landed on a fence and tore up his neck and hand. An ambulance was called. At the hospital, Mark was in a lot of pain and belligerent. He was given medication and a number of stitches. The next morning, he didn't recall a thing. This was a wake-up call for Mark. He knew his self-destructive behavior had to change. He He was lonely and unhappy. The sport was changing, and he was blowing his last chance at fame and fortune. Back home in California, Mark met a group of surfers who were into religion. Mark felt his life was missing something and joined a church, read the Bible, prayed, and used his newfound religion to teach young skaters. And now his new religion, Mark was enforcing more rules upon Brandy, but she'd had enough of his controlling ways, and the couple broke up one last time. Mark dropped his father's last name and went by his middle name, calling himself Mark Anthony, but it confused his fan base. Mark then cut ties with Vision Sports and went with another company who added religious symbols to his skateboard designs. His popularity was declining, and so was his income. Mark was done with the dating game and wanted to settle down. And despite their turbulent relationship, he knew Brandy was the one. But then Mark discovered that Brandy had been seeing someone else when they were still together. It broke Mark's heart, and he sought revenge. He broke into her parents' home and stole every gift he'd ever given Brandy. He began stalking her, phoning her home, and calling her names. He even told her he should take her somewhere, do what he wanted with her, then dump her naked body in the desert. This scared Brandy, to the point she left home and fled to New York and went into hiding. No one knew except her family. She didn't even tell her best friend Jessica. The Los Angeles Times reported that mid-March 1991, Mark traveled to Brandy's home with every intent to kill her. He knocked on her door. No one answered. A week later, on March 20th, Jessica, who was now an aspiring model, moved to San Diego. Brandy didn't know about Jessica's move and wasn't able to warn her about Mark. Jessica was pretty, intelligent, and still a party girl. She called Mark and asked him to introduce her to the party scene. Mark and Jessica went out for lunch, then back to his place to watch movies and drink wine. Sometime after midnight, Jessica got up to leave. Mark was going to drive her home. But then something in him snapped. So many emotions erupted in Mark all at once. Brandy and Jessica were two peas in a pod, with the same body type, same blonde hair, same partying ways that he now despised. He was still angry with Brandy, and in some distorted way, blamed Jessica for how Brandy turned out. And with his new religious beliefs, he felt Jessica was physically tempting him. Mark hadn't drank in a while, and the wine wasn't helping his thinking. He told Jessica he had to get something out of his car. Mark returned with a club used to lock the steering wheel. Jessica was sitting on the floor in the living room. He raised the club, and with all his athletic prowess, took the rage against Brandy out on Jessica, striking her head 3 times. Her blood pooled onto the carpet. Jessica was still conscious when he carried her upstairs to his bedroom and sexually assaulted her. She begged him to stop, and occasionally she let out a scream. Mark panicked, worried that the neighbors might hear. He opened his closet and pulled out a surfboard bag I placed Jessica inside and zipped it closed. She was having trouble breathing. Through the bag, Mark felt for her mouth, placed his hands on the bag, and pressed down until he didn't hear her breathing. Jessica died at 21. Mark couldn't sleep. When daylight broke, he cleaned up the blood and loaded Jessica's body into his car, along with the clothes and the murder weapon. He drove down the highway and exited at a ramp and drove up into the hills. Pulling over in a remote area, Mark stopped at a dry riverbed, dug a shallow grave, removed Jessica from the bag, and buried her body. In a daze, Mark drove nearly 500 miles to Phoenix, Arizona. Stopping at bridges, he discarded the evidence, the surfboard bag, the club, and Jessica's clothes. After a week, when Jessica's father in Arizona couldn't get hold of her, he reported her missing. He went to San Diego and plastered the area with missing posters. Meanwhile, on April 10th, 3 weeks after Jessica's murder, a young boy riding a four-wheeler came across a body in the desert. The elements had disposed of much of the flesh, revealing white bones. Investigators managed to get a few fingerprints, hoping for an identification. Eventually, Mark couldn't take the pressure. On May 8th, 6 weeks after he murdered Jessica, 24-year-old Mark turned himself into police. They were shocked by his confession. Jessica's body hadn't been identified yet, and they weren't even aware that she'd been murdered. Mark led investigators to where he'd buried her body. He was booked on suspicion of murder and rape and assault with a deadly weapon and held without bail. Fingerprints confirmed Jessica's identity, and blood samples taken from Mark's living room and bedroom matched Jessica. Mark was set to go to trial in January 1992, but in a surprise twist, on the day his trial was set to begin, he took a plea bargain and pled guilty to first-degree murder and forcible rape. Avoiding the death penalty, Mark was sentenced to 31 years in prison. In 2011, CBS News reported that Mark was denied parole. In December 2019, the parole board granted him parole, only to have the California governor reverse their decision. 2.5 years later, he was granted parole, and again, the governor reversed it. As of this writing, Mark is still behind bars. He has served 32 years. His next scheduled date for a parole hearing is December 2024. Thanks for listening to Murder in 20 with less talk and more true crime. Be sure to tune in next Wednesday for the episode of Shannon Graves. She had a heart of gold and would do anything for her friends. But when her volatile relationship with Arturo exploded, she disappeared. Her body locked away in the freezing cold. Until a friend discovered a terrible secret. If you're dying to hear more, past episodes of Murder in 20 are available for free at murderin20.com and on all major podcast platforms. We love what we do and are dying to continue. If you enjoy listening to Murder in 20 every week, we'd be eternally grateful for your support by visiting Murder in 20 at Patreon, PayPal, or murderin20.com. We'd like to acknowledge Verbal Planet for use of their music, sound effects from Vaseline Studios and Quick Sounds, and our many editorial sources who are listed on our website. Be sure to like, share, and follow us to learn about upcoming episodes every Wednesday. Stay safe, sleep with the lights on, and don't play with strangers.